Good morning, folks. Monday morning, August the 4th. We got a great show lined up for you today. We'll visit with Guy Williams in the 12 o'clock hour. He's the president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday at 12. And we'll talk about the case for and the case against the Fed rate cut. Also about auto troubles, part two for the American auto industry. Couple of more fraud schemes, the FedEx package delay and the fake credit bureau settlement gift card offer and the current state of tariffs. And we'll touch on the Cambodia-Thailand conflict as well and other issues. Joan Elker, executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy, will join us to talk about how will the big, beautiful bill affect rural hospitals in Louisiana. The Louisiana Illuminator recently did a Q&A with Jeff Reynolds, who is the Rural Hospital Coalition of Louisiana, and he's been working in the healthcare portion of state government under multiple governors here, to include John Bel Edwards and Bobby Jindal. And we'll talk about his observations about how that bill will impact Louisiana. Freddie King joins us, New Orleans City Council member, to talk about licensing. I talked a little bit about this, of ABO licensing and some of the problems and the fines and the fees that they're facing. A number of restaurants and bars are facing closures because of the difficulty and the lack of communication, I guess, between the permit office and these businesses. At 10:30, we'll check in with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. Believe it or not, the Saints' first preseason game this Sunday, August 10th, 3:05 p.m. They are taking on the Chargers out there on the West Coast. So we'll start practicing a little bit ourselves and getting into the NFL season with our New Orleans Saints. A lot going on. I think they're going to be packing up here soon and headed out there. We'll get all the details from Jeff Nowak. There was an interesting article over the weekend, NOLA.com. Stephanie Regal was the staff writer, relative to the Catholic Church and the bankruptcy settlement that's gone on, that's all about the molestation of kids by members of the clergy and others within the Catholic Church. And what I found interesting in this article, and just to go back and remind folks, when all of this first broke 4 or 5 years ago, as it related to this bankruptcy, and bits and pieces of information have been coming out for a long time, I recall that there were a number of assurances that were made. And one of the assurances was that the parishes would not ever have to participate in the financing of a settlement with the victims of molestation. It wasn't going to happen. Obviously, the church had a vested interest in making these assurances to the parishes because overwhelmingly people were really turned off by what they were hearing. People were second guessing whether or not they felt that safety and security that they had felt for years relative to Catholic education. So there were a lot of mixed emotions that were going on and a lot of mixed signals that were going on. In fact, it even got to the point where we had pastors going to the pulpit assuring their parishioners that it would never happen. And in some cases, they said if it did happen, they would personally finance it. That's how certain they were that it was not going to happen. Unfortunately for them, like many, they're not very sophisticated in business operations. Yes, the church is a religion, but two things can be true, and the other truth is that it's a business. And that in a court of law, whether it's the bankruptcy court or civil district court or otherwise, the business entity of the church faces the same difficulties, challenges, sanctions, and alike that any other business faces. In the church, like any other business, has bondholders, has commercial credit, debt, have a lot of people that have lent money to the church. One of the other assurances is that their commercial creditors would be made whole. Doesn't look like that's going to happen either. So there was a lot of information that was flying around, really relying more on the church as a faith as opposed to the church as a business. And the church as a business, obviously the underbelly of it, has not been very pretty at all. In fact, there's not been a whole lot of information that has been given out to many folks as to how this was ultimately going to play itself out. But if you look to other archdioceses around the country that were able to procure and reach the settlement phase in a much quicker fashion, in a much more orderly fashion, and in many cases, a lot cheaper, lawyers not making as much money as the defense lawyers on behalf of the church here, you find some very interesting things that obviously are not being talked about here, but we are probably going right down that same path, which I think will ultimately end up mystifying many parishioners. Because this has not been a transparent process by any stretch of the imagination. And it continues on today. In fact, kudos to Stephanie Regal for uncovering the document that was filed in the bankruptcy court. It is a public record. And talked about the fact that the business side of the church, for the first time, has made, you know, a documentary revelation that, I think it's for the first time, that the parishes were going to have to contribute. And they might be contributing, along with the what they call the apostolates, up to $60 million. Now, what's interesting about these numbers that are being bannered about in this article is that no one knows yet, still today, whether or not the victims are going to accept this offer. They're trying to piece together an offer. It's not a settlement because no one has agreed to that number. In fact, the number that the church is proposing, I'm told, is far less than what was asked for. So there may be still a huge delta. But what happened in other areas of the country relative to those archdioceses is that the parishes there, too, participated in the settlement. In fact, so much so that each parish was a part of what was called a pre-packaged bankruptcy. Every parish went into bankruptcy as part of the package. Now, that doesn't mean they couldn't come out of the bankruptcy. They can, and some did. Others did not. It's one of the byproducts of when you have this carrying on too long and not grasping the severity of the situation at hand, and not understanding what the business side of this was going to bring about. So you have commercial debtors now, and others, they're all coalescing on the same side as the victims. And the reason is clear. There were a number of assurances made by the archdiocese, none of which, for the most part, are turning out to be true. That these bondholders would be made whole. Commercial creditors would be paid off. Meanwhile, the Archbishop is communicating with the Vatican that the amount of indebtedness is going to be around $7 million. Unfortunately, we know now they're into their lawyer for over $40 million. And the case in the bankruptcy court keeps getting continued. Now it's in December. And as one lawyer told me many, many years ago, that is a hard and fast date until it's not. Because you never know what happens and where this is ultimately going to go. But the fact of the matter is, it just means more money. More money being spent. So the truth be told, the 104 parishes and 19 of its charitable organizations that make up the archdiocese, no one really knows what their ultimate amount of money is going to be that they owe, the amount of their debt. Roughly two-thirds of the parishes, according to this article, financial consultant Chris Linscott testified that two-thirds of the parishes do not even break even. They do not generate enough money to pay their expenses. You cannot get blood from a turnip. The reality there is that the other parishes that are more successful, that have more cash on hand, more working capital, may be asked to give up more, which creates even a bigger problem for those pastors that went to the pulpit and said that they would have to contribute nothing. And if so, they would pay for it. Interesting. So the long and short of where we are now, and these conversations, I've had a lot of conversations with folks. You have it in your all different types of groups that you participate in. And every time there's an article like this, people are scratching their head, wondering, when does this come to an end? How does this move out of the news? It moves out of the news when the church steps up and is willing to accept the responsibility of what they did, and in some cases, more importantly, what they didn't do. And the sooner that that happens, and the sooner that they're able to figure out exactly where they are, and the value of their assets and everything else, which I'm not sure that's part of the public record yet, after all this period of time, which is a head scratcher as well, do we get to some finality? Most importantly, for the victims who were sexually assaulted by predators disguised as priests, commercial lenders, bondholders, who would be reluctant to lend any more money to this archdiocese or any other, for that matter, because of the lack of transparency and the assurances that were given that have been, look like, reneged upon. It's not a pretty picture. And it's not one that's presenting truth nor honesty. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer, and he's getting ready for the big season that starts this Saturday already, if you can believe that. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. How have you been, Neil? It's been a while.
I know it's been a while, but getting, you know, pumped up, ready for the season. It's hard to imagine it already this weekend. They will be at the Chargers for 3:05 start time. I guess that's on Sunday, right?
Yeah, it's a Sunday preseason game. It's one of the last starts of this preseason kind of slate, which kind of is all throughout the week because they don't really have – it's just kind of a weird schedule for the preseason. But, yeah, the Saints are heading out to California on Wednesday. They have one more practice in Metairie. It's another open practice. Fans will be out there. And then they'll hop on a plane and take a 10-day trip back to Irvine, the same place we practiced last year for 26 days. This year they're going to be there for, I want to say, six practices kind of wrapped around the preseason game, which is an unusual thing. Usually it's, you know, a couple years ago when we went out to California, they did open practices ahead of a preseason game with the Chargers, or not open practices, but joint practices ahead of the preseason game with the Chargers, then came back immediately after. So it's going to be kind of another kind of unique wrinkle in Kellen Moore's first year of this kind of 10-day trip to break up the camp grind.
So, Jeff, you know, there are so many new names out there, both coaches and players. I know that you kind of reacclimate yourself to a bunch of the players. What are you seeing out there that really stick out in your mind each and every day?
Yeah, you know, you're building right now, so it's kind of that point in the training camp where you look at, especially with young players like a Tyler Shuck, the rookie quarterback they drafted, or even, you know, Quincy Riley, who's a young cornerback, Danny Stutzman, a young linebacker. You're looking for those guys to, you know, not be perfect, right? You're not going to be perfect as a rookie. You want them to take steps forward. You know, you establish a baseline, and then you want somewhere after a week to be above that baseline to some degree. And then, you know, you set another baseline and you kind of continue to stack days. And that's what we've seen. Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. I was talking to Jeff Duncan from NOLA.com about this yesterday, and it's been a very light practice load to this point. We haven't seen a lot of conditioning. You know, obviously part of going out in the sun in 96 degrees in Louisiana, there's going to be some level of conditioning with that. But we haven't seen, like, gassers or anything like that. And it's been a very kind of intentional practice schedule, which is aimed at rest and recovery, and they're tracking players' steps. And if they reach a certain point, they'll shut them down. Ted Rath, who's the new pro performance director, has a lot of these initiatives in place. Players seem to be appreciating it. And to this point, there's really been not a ton of injuries, knock on wood. Like, you've avoided the soft tissue issues. Obviously, there's been a couple. Nick Saldivari had a knee injury on Thursday's practice, and he's done for the year, which is a bummer for him. A couple other guys have gone down, but no real extended injuries to this point. So that's been kind of interesting to see. And on Sunday, yesterday, they had their longest practice. It was actually a full scrimmage, which is something we haven't seen a ton of in recent years. They ran 126 offensive plays, which, for perspective, the average game, you're looking at maybe 60 to 75 plays in a three-hour football game. Per side, right? And so the Saints offense yesterday ran about two games worth of offensive plays. So you really kind of ramped up the physicality. Guys were gassed a little at the end of practice, but I think we're reaching the point where they're going to start ramping up that physicality, and we'll see how they respond to that.
And probably getting into a little bit of a lighter climate, right, will help too. This is all about peaking at the right time at the beginning of the season, and instead of being in the recovery mode like we have found ourselves for many years with so many injuries we didn't know who was actually where.
Yeah. To me, it's like, you know, I don't know if it's going to work, right? But I'm at the point where it's like there's no bad ideas after what we've seen the last few years. Like the only thing that I would be critical of is trying to do the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, right? So, you know, I we'll see how it goes. To this point, the returns seem to be positive. It's way too early to make any determination. We'll have to get into the season and see how things play out. But I do think that if nothing else, there is a clear, intentional kind of plan in place for how they're going to try to keep guys healthy, how they're going to approach work and rest and recovery, very intentional schedule making. Like, for instance, they had the first padded practice outdoors. The second one was indoors. So they were, okay, we're going to go hard outdoors in pads. The next day we're going to give them kind of a, and then Friday they were off, right? And that's all intentional. Yesterday they did that long scrimmage because it's Sunday. It's a game day, right? So they're kind of getting into the mode of Sunday is where we're going to have our game and energy. So we're going to do our scrimmage on Sunday. They went through a full set of, you know, the same warm-ups you would see before a game. The scrimmage was scheduled to start at exactly 9:34 a.m., and that's when it did start. So it's just, I appreciate, and I think the players appreciate, you know, nothing happens, everything happens for a reason. Like, there's a reason that every decision is made, and so far I think that you can see these decisions kind of playing out and being effective.
It's been a long time since we've had a competition at the position of quarterback. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I think the last competition would have been Jameis and Taysom in the 2021 season. And then before that, I mean, yeah, Drew Brees never had to compete for his job. It was always his job. You know, I've seen one, you know, I think it's mainly Spencer Rattler and Tyler Shuck at this point. Jake Haener is in the mix there, but I think he's more in the mix to be kind of that backup, that game day backup. And, you know, you want him to be ready to go in. I think they're going to keep three quarterbacks. So if you do end up getting to him, you want him to be prepared to go in there. And I do think they'd be confident to put him in if they needed to. But right now it's kind of a, you know, if I'm Spencer Rattler, my mission is to stay steady, to make good decisions, to look like the more comfortable player, to run the offense. And for Tyler Shuck, it's more of kind of a race to get to the point where he looks ready to play in an NFL game. And I would say that Spencer has done a really good job of that from day one. You know, from day one of OTAs, he showed up and he just looked like a guy coming into year two, a lot more confident. Even in the new offense, he just seems to understand the concepts. He's getting the ball out on time. You know, he's not taking unnecessary risks. There have been a few, but a lot less than we saw last year. And for Tyler, you know, he came in and looked a little bit like a rookie. We've seen in the last couple days, he's starting to settle in. He's making quicker decisions. He's being a little bit more aggressive with his throws. There have been a couple interceptions, but I'm okay with that, right? Like, I think training camp is a time where you don't mind throwing interceptions because you learn from those. And the mistake you can make as a young player is trying way too hard to avoid negative plays, because then you never test the limits and you don't gain anything from scrambling in 7-on-7 drills and never getting the ball out. Like, I want you to take some risks, learn what you can and can't get away with. And I think we've seen him get a little bit closer to that over the last couple of days. There was only one touchdown drive yesterday, and he's the one who led it. He went 8 for 8 on that drive. So, you know, I'm encouraged with what I've seen from both of those guys. I'd still, at this point, if I had to pick a starter today, I'd go with Spencer Rattler. But I think Tyler has really kind of come along over the last week.
Let's talk about the front line while we're talking about offense. We've got multiple people playing out of their, I guess, natural position that they've played in historically. How's that working out?
Yeah, so we've seen, I think we've had 5 padded practices at this point, and that's really, you know, the first week of camp, there's no pads on. It's tough to make it high or low of how the offensive line is looking. I think, you know, it's Trevor Penning is the only guy who's kind of going to a new position. He's playing guard for the first time at the NFL level. He did play it in high school. He's looked really comfortable. You know, I talked to offensive line coach Brendan Nugent the other day, and you know, I asked him, like, why did you feel like that was a good position for him? And it's just, everyone kind of says the same thing. It's just less space, right? He just doesn't have to worry about waiting and being able to get beat to the outside with speed, to the inside with power. You know, he can just kind of lock in and take his guy. And obviously there's some stunts you're going to have to deal with at that spot. And I think that's going to be a little tough for him to adjust to. He's going to have to pull a lot in the run game, which means just kind of getting out of your stance and running across the line and getting to the strong side. He does look very comfortable, and he looks natural at that position, which is good to see. Fuaga is going back to the right side, which is where he played in college, so he looks very comfortable out there. Kelvin Banks is the left tackle. You know, he's a rookie, so he's going to be kind of rookie moments, but I think he's held up pretty well to this stage, and we'll see how that looks in the preseason games. My only concern at this point is we haven't seen much in the run game. And so I'm hoping that is more of a case of the Saints' run defense has been playing very well. And so that's kind of the balance you have to strike of, like, man, I wish we were seeing more out of the Saints' running backs. But I think Devon Godshaw has been kind of a revelation at that nose tackle spot. Everyone keeps talking about how big and strong he is. Even in a league of big and strong guys, he stands out. And so I think they've spent a lot of time this offseason trying to find ways to shore up that run defense where they got gashed so often last year. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. But all in all, I've been pleased with what I've seen from the offensive line.
Let's talk about DB play. Honey Badger deciding to retire. Was that a surprise to the coaching staff? Do you know?
It wasn't a surprise on like the day it happened, right? Like it was definitely a decision that was made in the off time between mini camp and training camp. So, you know, anytime you find out, you know, less than a month before camp starts that a guy is retiring, it's going to be a surprise. So whatever time they had to adjust to it was not significant. But there's also the level of, hey, you're talking about a 12-year NFL veteran. I think at any point that guy can opt to retire and you have to be prepared for it, because it does sound like they were in talks with Julian Blackman long before that. So there was always kind of the idea that they could bring in Julian as kind of a depth option. And they ended up, hey, Tyron's not here anymore. You're our starter now. And that probably greased the skids on like the opportunity to come in and start right away for a fifth-year player who's got 60 starts in his career, 10 interceptions. That's a much more enticing situation than, hey, we're going to see what happens. Maybe you'll back this guy up. But they had the foresight to kick the tires on Julian Pryor. And I think they were very fortunate that he was available and ready to come in, because he's been a guy, I didn't know a ton about him. I watched him play one time with the Colts when the Saints went out there, and Saints offense kind of beat him up in that game. But Julian, he's just come in and been a pro, right? Like, he's a veteran player. Him and Justin Reed have meshed, and the communication there has been really impressive. One thing that I appreciated about Julian is he played last year. He tore his labrum, or he had a labrum injury in week one, a shoulder injury. And he played in 16 games. He played through that injury basically all season. And we asked him, you know, okay, why did you decide to play through that injury? And he was like, well, the team asked me to. And we kind of just stood there like waiting for the other, you know, the end of that sentence. And it was like, oh, but like, so I did, right? Like, that's like, he's a team guy. And I thought that was kind of a, you know, you want guys with that type of attitude. It was like, well, they asked me to play through it, so of course I played through it. Not everyone would have that type of mentality, and, you know, maybe 20 years ago, not in today's NFL. So you appreciate that kind of veteran leadership. And I think he's going to come in, and yeah, I think they may have gotten better on the back end, just in terms of, I think Julian and Justin Reed could end up being your safety tandem for multiple seasons, not just this season. He is on a 1-year deal, but I've been really impressed with how they've looked. As far as the outside, Kool-Aid McKinstry looks very confident. I think he's kind of ready to step into that CB1 role. He got an interception yesterday. I think he's going to soon be a guy that other offenses are like, hey, why don't we throw to the other side of the field based on how he's been playing. And the question I have right now is, who's that guy on the other side of the field? Because Ike Yiadom is here. He's a player that was here 2 years ago, ended up going out to San Francisco last year where he hooked up with Brandon Staley. He's probably in line to be that starter right now on the outside with Alante Taylor playing in the nickel spot. But then you have Quincy Riley, who's a rookie cornerback they brought back in last year. He's got multiple interceptions in camp already. He's kind of a ball hawk. So he'll be competing for that spot as well.
I guess, Jeff, we're visiting with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. We kind of got used to the manner in which Sean Payton utilized preseason. Dennis Allen kind of did a couple of things different, but for the most part, same type of strategy. Do we expect anything different from Kellen Moore?
It's tough to say at this point, you know, because he wasn't even making those decisions with the Eagles. That would have been Sirianni who got to make those calls. You know, we'll find out more. We'll see if he's more forthcoming than the other guys had been in the past. I've always thought it was funny that, you know, coaches were coy about their preseason rotations, because, like, what are you trying to protect? But I would expect to see, just because it's a new offense, like, you need guys to get out there, especially with the young quarterbacks and the new offensive line rotation. Like, you need those guys to get reps. So I would expect to see all the starters out there in week one. Maybe like a Juwan Johnson, who's been, you know, nursing a groin injury and been a little limited. I could see maybe they hold him out. Maybe even an Alvin, who I don't think you really need to see anything from in the preseason, and the running backs behind him is a way bigger question anyway. But I think you'll see the first team offensive line. I think you'll see all three quarterbacks. So it'll be definitely, you know, as far as preseason openers go, I think this will be one of the more watchable, at least on the offensive side of the ball, that we've seen in a while.
Yeah, that kind of I thought the same thing. Just, you know, you have your guys like Alvin. What else is he going to what else does he have to show you, right? You know,
right.
It'll be interesting, especially because we really hadn't had that big competition at quarterbacks. So it'll be interesting to see how they divide up the snaps there for sure. As always, Jeff Nowak, it's always a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. Have a great week.
For sure, Noel. Thanks for having me.
All righty. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. Last week, we visited with Colonel Alex Gann from the former Israeli pilot. And we talked about the complexities of what was going on. And, you know, I asked the question, you know, how do you get to an end when the other side continues to talk about their desire to kill you because you are an Israeli or you're Jewish? And so over the weekend, kind of looking around, found this public opinion poll that was conducted by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research. And it revealed the following. This poll was actually conducted in May of this year, 2 months ago. And it revealed that 64% of Gazans and 85% of West Bank residents oppose disarming Hamas. 73% overall reject the idea that the war would end even if Hamas released Israeli hostages. It also revealed that 41% of Palestinians in general, 48% on the West Bank, 31% in Gaza, said armed struggle is the best way forward. So this overwhelms and outpaces any support for peace. Nearly half of Gazans, 49%, would still vote for Hamas if elections were held today. 43% of Palestinians still say Hamas is most deserving to lead them compared to 19% for Fatah, which is who's actually leading the Palestinians on the West Bank. So given the choice of Fatah or Hamas, they choose, the majority of Palestinians choose Hamas. Still today. And we question why Israel is conducting itself in the manner in which it conducts itself, because this enemy continues to want to engage in an armed struggle. And this enemy continues with their strong desire to kill Jews. In fact, only 12% of Gazans blame Hamas for the humanitarian crisis. The vast majority blame Israel. And guess who else? Yeah, you got it. The United States. They don't want a peaceful two-state solution. In fact, the support for a two-state solution is polls at 40%. 64% believe the two-state solution is really no longer practical. You wonder why? We'll be right back. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member. We'll talk about ABO licensing, alcohol beverage outlet licensing, and some of the fines that a number of our businesses are having to face. And in the back half of the 11 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Joan Alker, executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. We'll talk about the big, beautiful bill and its impact on rural hospitals. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.